It's July 2nd, 2023, and welcome to episode 267 of the Retro Computing Roundtable.
Well, it seems the Emerald City is far behind me now. And my world has changed back from black to white. But no matter where I go, there's just one thing I'd like to know. Will I ever find my way back to Oz? Will I ever find...
The RCR is a podcast about retro computer news, nostalgia, collecting, and turtles, I guess. So, I'm Paul Hagstrom, near Boston. I am joined today by three retro computing enthusiasts. Quinn Dunkey from... what did we say you are? Rural British Columbia?
Rural British Columbia, yes. And it's very hot here today, so I apologize in advance if the air conditioner kicks in. I don't think it will because it's still early in the day here, but yes, it is lovely here.
Excellent. Also joining us is Earl Evans from Portland. How are you?
I'm doing well, thank you. It is hot here, and it's going to continue to be hot from what I understand, 80s and 90s and those fake Fahrenheit things.
And also joining us is Blake Patterson, near D.C. How are you?
Oh, I'm doing well. I am near D.C. and I'm very, having been outside earlier, those of us near D.C. are in an extremely muggy and hot and sort of can't decide if it wants to be fully rainy or just miserable, miasmic. Yeah, it's quite a day out there. Anyway, yep, I am here and anxious to talk about turtles and other such things. So,
yep. While we're on the weather, I'd just like to apologize on behalf of Canada for our entire country being on fire.
Are you guys going to figure that out? Like,
we're working on it. Yeah, we just flew in some Koreans was the new thing. Like, we're flying in firefighters from all over the world. Look, it's a really big place and there's not that many of us, so we're working on it, but... yeah, the entire northern half of BC now is basically on fire, and the whole firefighting team is just like, I don't know, like, we're just going to let it go because there's nothing we can do.
Well, I thought it was over to the east. You're saying parts of British Columbia?
Yes, is the answer. Someone asks which part of Canada is on fire. The answer is currently yes. yeah, the northern Ontario ones were really bad. Those are under control now. In May, it was Alberta was on fire, and now it's BC. So luckily, the smoke doesn't seem to be blowing south from that fire, so it's not affecting me or my friends to the south. But yeah, it's a pretty bad situation up here.
Yeah, it's strange, yeah. And I do feel bad for it. Obviously, I joke. It is. I mean, you know, like all week, much of the week, DC was in red and then purple mode. You know, so we're like hunkered in, staying inside. You know, 40 times worse than a cigarette kind of thing, apparently. But the strange thing is, I'm down in DC, and then I have a couple of coworkers that are on Long Island, and they're just totally clear. You know, and here down all the way down in North Carolina, and it's given me a different perspective on. I mean, I guess I kind of know where the jet stream goes, but I didn't get this other kind of downward thing. So I do hope that people aren't, it sounds like these aren't highly populated areas, I guess you're saying, and that sounds good.
No, I mean, it's cause and effect. Like, the reason the fires get so big is because it's unpopulated up there. That's part of it. And that's also why we tend to let them burn, because we're not going to pour huge amounts of resources into putting something out if there aren't immediate, you know, lives in danger or property in danger. But those areas are also very remote, like northern BC, where the big Donnie Creek fire is. Like, there aren't even roads up there, you know. So how do you put out a fire like that when there aren't even roads? So, you know, helicopters, airplanes, but mostly you just kind of let it burn because that's really the most effective thing to do. But yeah, it's very much down to the wind. Like, the wind is very unpredictable, and you know, it's been perfect here. We've had no issues, but there's towns 2 hours to the west of me that have been smoky since May or whatever. Like, it's just the winds are random and unfortunate for some people.
Rough. Yeah, it seems where I am seems to have mostly been clear of the smoke, but I mean, you know, the smoke is a problem, but you know, it doesn't seem like it's the worst of the associated problems.
I saw a funny tweet the other day from an American that said, look, Canada, we know we've made a lot of fun of you over the years, but ruining the air quality in all of our major cities seems like an over-response. Which I thought that was sort of funny.
Okay, let's see. So here we are. It's episode 267, and what we have been doing when we record, we skipped all of June, by the way. So,
yeah, but, sorry about that.
Just kicking back.
That's right. We've been sort of going through the years that correspond to the episode number, and we have reached 1967. So, just as a host topic, we would talk a little bit about a couple things that happened in 1967. So maybe the first of them we could mention is the floppy disk.
I did a little bit of research on that. It started in 1967 with some R&D, and this was IBM trying to figure out an effective way to get the microprograms onto their bigger systems. So they came up with the idea of what was originally a read-only 8-inch floppy disk that they could send out to installations and have people load up. I guess it was for the System 360, maybe, if I read it right.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, some other folks looked at this and said, hey, this could just be a good storage medium in general, so let's make read-write versions of it. And out of all this, the floppy disk and the floppy disk drives were born. I guess in 1971 is the year that they actually started being available. And then obviously the rest is history, as they say. I mean, floppy disks typify the entire 70s and 80s. All of our experiences with our microcomputers were, if you'll pardon the pun, revolving around floppy disks.
So, I'm not sure that I will.
I will pardon it.
Thank you. So I just thought I'd throw that out because that was, you know, a cornerstone of our entire experience with microcomputers. I used to love buying a new box of floppy disks. Just, yeah. You know, everything about it. Tearing off the cellophane, the smell, formatting them, getting them ready for your favorite microcomputer. It was all fun. And the computer store that I worked at, in the back storage area that we didn't go to very often and that had a lot of dust on it, there were several boxes of these ginormous floppy disks that I didn't understand. I looked at them, picked up a box, and it's like 8-inch floppy disk. What in the world would you put this in? And later on, I found out that actually there were computers that did that.
Ask David Lightman.
Yeah, those I always find them kind of funny when I pick an 8-inch floppy up because I sort of feel very small.
That's right. Did I shrink or did this disc just get bigger?
I was kind of like the Lisa floppies, the Twiggy floppies. They have just sort of this weird alien construct where it's sort of like mirrored. It's got two windows and way more little punch outs mm-hmm. than most. But
yeah, I quite enjoyed the experience of the floppies. I remember when I had I had a TI-99 first computer with a tape drive, and I was taking like a programming summer class on an Apple II lab at a middle school nearby, and you know they had the floppy disks on the Apple II, and it was, you know, every chance I get, I'd put a disk in and load something, you know, the physical interaction was really cool. And then finally I got a drive and it was nifty. But I was also going to say some of the, there's some weirdo, well, at least to Yanks over here, some of the, 3-inch, 2.5-inch right. formats, it didn't really catch on. I remember there was I think it's called a mini floppy or something. It's like a 3-inch hard cased unit that was popular in Britain on like some of the Amstrads, and maybe, you know, some of the later home computers there. And I remember Amdek made a drive unit for the like Apple II Atari, and they failed. And I picked one up, you know, one of those clearance $30 for a drive. And I had fun playing with this very alien, you know, hard case, hard shell floppy. I think I know we've talked about it on the show before, that format, but yeah, it's interesting how many different physical, you know, sizes came and went, and most of them went.
Well, yeah.
Yeah. Well, they all went.
Was that the stringy drive that you were talking about?
No, I know Sinclair was big on the stringy drive, and I think there were some other but no, it was for YouTube watchers, it's the unit pictured on the left. It's a compact floppy disk, I think. Maxell, I think, was the only group that made disks for those, but I remember I put that was my drive 2 on an Apple IIe I had. So when I would play Ultima 4, the first flippy disk was 5 1/4, and the other one was this weird hard cased, and I actually still have it up on the wall with Ultima 2 Britannia disk written on the label. So
probably not as purchased.
No, I don't think so. But they did. apparently, in Europe, there were Amstrad put on, and I think Sinclair had a drive that did use them. So they saw much more use over there than here. And of course, I noticed that even smaller, stranger discs appeared in these word processing computers. Do you remember Canon and different companies? You'd see them on sale, and electronic stores would have these dedicated. They would have a CRT and a printer, and they really wouldn't do much else unless you were to hack it, which I guess sometimes you could, but they would have sometimes just their own format, little physical media. And I remember seeing some college, classmates in their dorms with these weird things, and I'd always, take note of the disc.
Word processors and electronic music synthesizers,
keyboards. Yep.
Certain verticals had their own weird floppy formats that didn't really show up anywhere else.
Right. Right.
Interesting. I never saw those.
If I remember, 2.5 inch and a 2 inch, and they were really thin. Yeah.
Did we all start with tape, or did you start straight with a floppy drive with your first microcomputers?
I used a little bit of tape. I had one of those, what were those, Radio Shack portable computers, the really little ones? They were overgrown calculators.
Oh, the MC-10?
Maybe, yeah. So I had one of those, and it had a tape interface that I used a couple of times. But otherwise, yeah, my desktop machines, I was straight to floppies.
Yeah, for me, I basically got there after the disk drive. So, I mean, I played around a little bit with tapes. The computer was capable of doing tapes, and I could connect with them, but I never, it was just experimentation, really. I never had any purchase programs on them or anything like that.
Yeah, there was the TI I mentioned. There was at the time I went to church and Sunday school and all that, and there was these two kids that were also had TIs, and they would lend me tapes, and I'd load them up and try to, it took a while to figure out, how to find the, where the thing was on the tape, because you had to listen for the silence and then the, but then eventually got a 5 1/4 inch drive. And of course, when you got a 5 1/4 inch drive for a TI-99, you got some hardware because of that enormous, microwave oven sized, peripheral box. But I will say, and Quinn will appreciate this, and maybe you noticed this, I don't know if you've only had a 2C Plus or if you also had a earlier 2C Quinn, I remember I always avoided Verbatim, and I think Data Life was associated. I think they might have been the same company, because when I would eject them from the 2C, it had that spring-loaded, it would literally shoot it off the side of the desk. They must have been much more fluid, less texture or something, but it absolutely...
More aerodynamic, I think.
Something, absolutely. It would shoot out of my, unless I caught it, it would go right off the desk. And so I just...
See, I see that more of a feature.
I didn't like it. I avoided them at all costs. That
the
was annoying.
The 2C's 5 1/4 inch ejection spring was impressive. It would fire that disc into your hand.
Oh, yeah.
It was nice.
Yeah.
It was very efficient when you were flipping discs a lot.
Yeah. I think I remember the balance and the overall aerodynamics of the Maxell floppies were my favorite. They felt the best to me. But, stay away from those Verbatims.
The TRS-80 pocket computer, I think, is what I had. I'm trying to find pictures of it. It went by a bunch of different names.
The smaller one with a one line.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, a little one line display. Okay. Yeah. It went by a bunch of different names. Mine didn't say TRS-80 on it, but I'm looking on oldcomputers.net, and I see that some of them did. But I think they were all the same device that just came in different packaging. But so I did have one of those, and my experience with that was enough to make me glad that I missed the tape era on the Apple II, because loading and storing programs on that thing was just really painful on tape. Just so slow and you didn't know if it was going to work. And if you didn't have the gain set just right, it wouldn't work and you'd lose everything forever. And that was terrible.
I always thought it was interesting. I came to learn now with, you know, all the online retro pals, you know, chatting about their history, but the Retro Gamer magazine, which I've been subscribing to for like 15 years now out of England, I got all of their, I learned a lot about their history. And I think, you know, one of the most popular systems, we talk about it here with some frequency, the ZX Spectrum, you know, super popular, in line with the C64. I think almost no one ever used a floppy drive with that, like the whole time of its run. Like that was a cassette system, period. I mean, you could add a floppy, I think. I think the Commodore 64 got more floppy adoption, although its floppy drive is about the same speed as its cassette drive, as far as I recall. But yeah, it kind of amazed me looking back that it was all tape all the time for the ZX Spectrum.
Yeah, and that was true. That was true of all of their early 8-bits. Is that they were very late to get floppies. I think they were a lot more expensive there, so they people stuck with tape much, much longer than we did here. I think here in the States and Canada, especially for the Apple II, we had the benefit of those really cheap Shugart mechanisms that everybody used. And so floppy adoption was, I think, a lot faster and easier here. Thank goodness.
By the way, just speaking of the floppy shooting across the table, I will put up the little video of ejecting a floppy from a Mac Portable on the space station, which is kind of funny because it like shoots across the room. I think it's here somewhere. There it is. Yeah.
That's incredible.
Yeah.
I love that.
Yeah. If that had been a 2C, I think the 2C was outlawed on the stations. They're like, you know, too dangerous.
Yeah, it was too dangerous. Yeah.
Yeah. You wouldn't have seen the disc. It just gone and ricocheted. Yeah.
Right through the wall.
That's actually what happened to Apollo 13. Little known fact.
Brought their 2C. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's right.
All right. Well, of the two topics we were going to talk about, I went with the floppy disk first because I thought, oh, we'll just get through that quickly. But that was a silly thought. The other thing that is attributed to 1967 is the creation of Logo, the programming language. So this is when Seymour Papert, I guess, basically designed it. Many of us have some experience with Logo in our youth. So I think many are itching to talk. So someone start.
Why don't you start, yeah. Gwen?
All right. So I think everybody knows what Logo is. A lot of people may not be aware that it's actually a dialect of Lisp. So it came from a very pure kind of academic origin, even though most of us probably experienced it as sort of a kid's toy that you played with in computer class and, you know, in school. But it's actually quite a sophisticated academic exercise, the design of the language, which I always found in hindsight really, really cool that, unlike BASIC, which BASIC is much more of like a working man kind of language. It's very pragmatic and very clunky and very, designed for the purpose that it was used for, whereas Logo is much more elegant and comes from much more of a pure computer science kind of background rather than a pragmatic, clunky software engineering sort of thing. That BASIC was. So I think I like that a lot about it. I want to talk about Logo Writer, which was a lesser known variant. So I don't know if there's something more, Blake, maybe you want to talk about Logo in general before I do that?
No, why don't you go ahead? I just have some recollections, but no, I think you're good.
So in addition to the Logo that I think many of us have probably used, you know, Apple Logo, I think, was kind of the first commercial one that we probably all used. There was a variant later in the 80s that's really little known called Logo Writer, and it's actually really hard to find information on this thing. There was a couple of decades there where I wasn't sure if I'd maybe imagined the whole thing in a fever dream because I couldn't find any references or information about it online. Luckily, now you can find some information. So Logo Writer it's sort of like a sequel, if you will, to Logo. And there's still very little information on it. I did manage to find a screencast of it on archive.org that shows some of what it's about. And it is basically Logo, but it has a couple of really key features. The big one is that you can change the shape of the turtle. So you can make it look like other graphics. So you can basically, this turtle becomes a sprite. And so you can make that sprite look like other things. And then you can also do things like you can have multiple turtles, and you can stamp copies of the turtle down. And then it also had some techniques for solid filling areas and some other things that traditional logo didn't do. And if you put all of that together, what you actually get is a video game creation kit for 12-year-olds. And so that's what me and my friends did a lot of in junior high, was we played with Logo Writer, making little demos and games out of it. I think the intention of the design was to allow educators to build really interactive, interesting lessons. So I have on the screen an example of something that was written to teach order of operations in arithmetic. So this is, amusingly, this was done in 2008. So I like how recent this is. But so he's built this animated thing that allows you to visualize how order of operations works. Just a simple example, but I think that was the intention of Logo Writer, was to make it easy for a teacher to do this type of thing who isn't necessarily a programmer. Has anybody else heard of Logo Writer or ever seen it?
I've heard the name before, but I actually did not understand what it was until you just described it now.
The name is strange. I don't know why they call it that. It's really like Logo 3 or something, I would call it, because I think there was a Logo 2, but so this is maybe 3. But I don't know why they named it that, but it's just a kind of it's Logo with a like graphics excitement layer on top of it, if you will, like a graphics library sitting on top of it. And they've also spiffed up the interface a lot. The original Apple logo was very primitive, right? Like you booted it into, and you just, it booted straight into a Logo prompt, and it wasn't easy to necessarily like store a bunch of programs and bring them up and edit them and stuff. Whereas Logo Writer, maybe that's why they called it that, because Logo Writer has a nice, it's an IDE basically. It's a Logo IDE. So it gives you file management and a nice editor and a nice way to test your programs and debug them and iterate on them. So it has all of that stuff kind of built into it, which the original logo didn't. The original logo was very much just a logo prompt. You got an interpreter that you booted into and that was it. So, and in addition, they've spiffed it up a lot. So there's text and fonts and a graphic turtle editor and all these nice little things. So that made it all a lot of fun to use. So yeah, I strongly recommend for checking out Logo Writer if anyone is interested in a lesser known variant. Like I said, it's still, I can't find screenshots of this thing. I can't find any info except this one screencast. This was the best I could find for some, and for an example of the kinds of things that it would do.
And I'm sorry, Quinn, what platform did you say that ran on?
It was ported to a bunch. So this screencast is on DOS, and it also was on Apple II, which is where I used it. I think it was ported to a few other platforms as well.
Not to undercut what you just said about it being hard to find stuff, but I did find one thing while we were talking, which is on the Daily Papert site, which it says it's dedicated to sharing the words and wisdom of Seymour Papert on a regular basis. Okay. But so there's a VHS tape where he demos some of like what Logo Writer's doing, and so you can watch it. It's on Vimeo, but he sort of like walks through the features of it, I guess, and it's transcribed underneath so you can read it if you don't want to watch the video. Although I think you lose a lot.
Yeah, that's awesome. Yeah, I'll take a look at that. And it's fairly early too. Like this is, the date on this is 1986. I think I used it late 80s, would have been probably 88, something like that when I was using it. This tape that's playing on the screen is great. It shows you the kind of fancy graphics and text and stuff that you could do with it. I think most of us, when we think about Logo, we think of like a high-res spirograph on the Apple II. Like you can draw little flowers and swirly rectangles, like rotating squares and things that we all made, Logo do. But this shows it as much more of, Logo Writer was much more of like an application development environment. It just happened to be underpinned by Logo. So it's neat to see it used in this way instead of just the basic turtle graphics that we've all seen.
Yeah, that does sort of bring it into a different level of use where you actually are really programming other educational things. It's not just learning about like how to make a procedure and a subroutine and stuff like that.
Yeah. I think the effort here was, hey, Logo is a great language. It's a very elegant language, but we're not really doing very much with it aside from teaching kids how to draw rectangles with the turtle. So what else could we actually do with it? And I assume that's the mindset that Logo Writer came out of. Speaking of the turtle, has anyone ever used the original turtle, the actual robot that ran on the floor and with the little pen?
No, I wish.
I've seen it in a museum or a rendering of it.
There was, when I was growing up, I was in the Minneapolis area, and there's a science museum there, and they had an exhibit for a while where it was just like a big arena with a turtle in it and like a logo console on the side, so you could sort of, like, everyone could take their turn programming the thing to go forward and left and stuff. I'm not sure that it had a pen, but it was pretty fun to make the thing go.
Yeah, I actually did once. So I think, like many of us, I'm sure, I went to programming summer camps when I was little. And one of those camps had the actual turtle robot, and it was perpetually broken, but there was one day when they had it working. And so we all got like 10 minutes with it each to play with it. And yeah, they put a big piece of paper on the floor, and it had a felt tip pen inside of it, and the pen would go up and down, and it would draw your little rectangles, and it was super, super cool. It was very slow, but it was really, really cool. So once and exactly once, I got to use the real turtle robot for which the turtle graphics are named. And I was reading on Wikipedia before the show that apparently the turtle that we all know, the one on screen where it's a little triangle or a little graphic of a turtle, the reason they named it turtle was after the robot, because they had done this as a way to visualize what the robot would be doing. This is supposed to be like a turtle robot simulator. But of course, this is a lot more convenient for everyone to use, so this became the standard. But this was originally just supposed to be a visualizer or a simulator for the turtle robot. So it's kind of neat that that's how it started. Yeah, for anyone who hasn't seen a turtle robot, they look like an upside-down salad bowl with hidden wheels underneath, and there was a felt-tip pen that was kind of inside the middle of the salad bowl on a little servo arm that would go up and down. Mm-hmm. So that's why the turtle commands to start and stop drawing are pen up and pen down, because originally it was literally a mechanical pen that went up and down. But yeah, they just look like a little salad bowl that drives around on the floor.
Yep. Yeah, and probably several years ago now, the gift idea was like a Roomba that you could program. Like, it was missing the vacuum part, but it was a sort of a programmable little disc that you could drive around.
Let's see. So I guess what my memory of Logo was when I was I got my first computer, which, as I mentioned before, was a TI-99. When we bought it and talked to the different, I went to the store to, sort through, what we were going to buy, which happened to be a sewing machine store, actually, a Singer sewing machine store, which I think I've mentioned before. One of the things that was promoted by the salespeople was Logo, for programming. And I actually had never, didn't have a computer. I didn't know BASIC. And so Logo was going to be this interesting thing. So shortly after we got the computer, we bought a new package. TI had recently come out with, they had a Logo version with the earlier TI-99-4, and they had recently come out with Logo 2. Quinn mentioned that there was a, Logo 2, and it had, more features. The TI package was a bit more visual. It had more colors. It had more capabilities. Actually, I'm sure there's a standard variety of features between Logo 1 and 2, and I actually should look that up. I'm curious to know. But anyway, so it came in one of these classic TI enormous binders with cartridges with floppy disks that had examples and extensions, and it was fun. I remember doing all the Logo stuff. That was the first time I'd seen the turtle on the screen, so that was a big part of my first memories with home computing, was using TI Logo 2 on the TI, and that was fun. I think later it was a high school class that was before the proper programming class. There was a short couple of days talking about Logo as a example of how programming languages can be structured, and I think there was the teacher got hold of a non-functional physical turtle. It didn't quite look like the salad bowl, but I think he had used it in some previous life or something like that. The other piece I was going to mention is I actually, I guess about 4 or 5 years ago, no, 10 years ago, I'm looking at the date of the blog post that I had put together about it. I was doing there are these little programming competitions at the subreddit on Reddit, the Retro Battle Stations, area, which is, they can be a lot of fun. And one of them was to use Logo to do something. And I had Logo on my Amiga 1000. And so I fired up the Logo system and created a, it was just a graphical thing. It was a sequence for drawing. The Amiga draws itself, and then it was autumn, so I have it drawing leaves on the screen with various, you know, repeated nested functions, or I don't even know if they're called functions in Logo. I can't recall what they are, what those things are termed. But it was a lot of fun, actually. So I wouldn't have guessed that 10 years, you know, prior to me at this age, I would be programming Logo, but I was, and that was a nice revisit. Yeah, that's my memories of the of Papert's programming gift to us.
Excellent. You know, now it's fairly easy to find interpreters online if you want to play with it in sort of modern contexts. There's a Logo interpreter at calormen.com where you can, you know, make your trees or whatever sorts of things you want to make. There's also a pretty cool, I haven't played with it that much, but there's a thing called Turtle Spaces that Melody and April Ayers-Griffith, I think, are the ones that are sort of responsible for this. So they're Kansas Fest regulars and Apple II community people. But this is not Apple II based, but it's kind of like adding 3D to a Logo environment, and it's largely supposed to be kind of, you know, in support of education, I guess. But so if you wanted to try running your turtle around in 3D spaces, mm-hmm. you can do that. I haven't played with it very much, but it's one of the sort of modern things you can do.
Turtle Spaces is really neat. It's a pretty awesome piece of work. So yeah, congrats to them for that. It's pretty awesome. I've played with it a little bit.
Mm-hmm. Cool. It does look interesting. Anxious to try it out.
Okay. Maybe we've made it through our 1967 topics.
But just one more honorable mention.
Oh. Okay.
Star Trek debuted in 1967, and it's not a computer, but it heavily featured computers and technology on the show, like it was just a part of day-to-day life that people would use them. And it's one of the things that was noted when I was looking at the timeline of computing history. People said, well, you know, it's not a computer, but there were lots of computers. So I thought I'd throw that in, being a lifetime Star Trek nerd that I am.
Mm-hmm. You know, my favorite thing about the original Star Trek is that they didn't anticipate a display technology better than CRTs. If you look at the original, the original Star Trek technical manual, those books are a lot of fun, especially the Next Generation one, but that had all of the like blueprints that were, you know, it's the books are, if you haven't seen them, the books are written they're supposed to be of the future, right? So it's how, it's like if you're Scotty, this was the current technical manual that you had on your desk, and it shows blueprints of the consoles on the bridge and everything, and they're all the side views of the consoles. The blueprints show space for CRTs, like they have these, they show the picture tubes being set into the ceilings. Like I find it fascinating that they didn't anticipate that we'd ever have anything better than CRTs for displaying graphics and such.
I wonder I'd like to see what the schematic was for the, you know, the big front and center monitor that all the enemies talk to. Maybe that was a projector.
I don't remember what they said about the view screen. I probably it was a projector.
A hell of a CRT, I guess.
Yeah, it would be.
I think I still have my copy of that book. I could probably look it up.
Yeah, I think I have
Michael
Okuda. Yeah, I think so. It was both the original and the next gen one were written by like the prop people, basically the prop and set dressing people. The next gen one is really nice. Like that's a really fun read. They definitely, it's a little more forward thinking, I guess. It's really beautifully illustrated.
Yeah, I am a fan of whether or not it's sacrilegious of both Star Trek and Star Wars. And I've certainly seen the schematic books of the latter, but I'd never, now I'm really curious. I want to see, what was the name of the author, Earl?
I think there are two authors, and one of them was Michael Okuda, who was a graphic designer actually for the show. And he collaborated on the book. And like Quinn was saying, it was a fictional book about a fictional show, but it was supposed to be real. So when you're reading it, you're, you know, like suspending disbelief.
Yeah, and sure. That's
it's
great.
It's like you're actually reading the tech spec for the ship.
That's
which,
great.
By the way, there was one interesting thing in there. Star Trek Next Gen fans would get this. In that technical manual, they talk about the ability of the saucer section to make a terrestrial landing in an emergency.
Right. Yep.
And when I read that, I thought, they're going to do that someday.
Yeah.
And they didn't do it in the series, but they did it in the movies.
Yep.
And I remember thinking, you know, when the saucer section started to head toward the atmosphere and Data let out a curse word, I was like, oh, they're going to bump it up a little bit.
Yeah.
It did.
Yeah. I remember at the time a lot of mainstream viewers were like, that was so dumb, that would never work. And all of us real fans were like, well, actually, the original technical manual specified that was a supported feature of the saucer section. Yeah.
It's a little bit of a rough landing, as I recall.
Yes, it was.
It left a mark.
Yeah, so I guess we'll do items of interest in the news. And Blake, you have the first of these.
Yes. So the item that I picked it for a couple of reasons. One of them is kind of unique amongst the crowd gathered around the table here today. Evan Koblenz has created a 1970s-style big block eight-cylinder engine reproduction using Legos. And not only using Legos, but using retro Legos, only Legos that were available from the 70s and 80s. I'm using plural. I should say Lego. Only Lego from the...
I was going to say, we're going to get email. Americans say Legos, which is incorrect. It is actually the plural of Lego is Lego or Lego bricks.
Okay, so I did
catch
myself.
But Americans say Legos.
To my credit, I caught myself sensing. I could feel the growing, you know, the coming tension.
Is this going to be like a Z versus Z?
I think it's theoretically, it seems to be pretty proper and defined. It's Lego, not Legos, but yes. So he only used Lego bricks that he went to a Lego a convention of some sort and gathered up a great many of these retro bricks, put it together during the shutdown. And it actually, It runs. It's eight cylinders. It has all of the cams, the valve covers, the spark plug. There are lights that flash that represent the spark plugs firing, and it's controlled. I guess the tie-in here for the show is it's controlled by a Apple II clone, his Laser 128, and he uses the Laser 128 to basically handle the spark plug action. As I mentioned, it uses LEDs to show there's no internal combustion actually taking place in this plastic Lego construct, but. Yes, so that's all coordinated. He lists in a YouTube video on his blog post page. It shows the listing of the basic program that handles it, and the he's using some. It's kind of a predecessor to the predecessor to the predecessor as far as interface unit to the current Lego Mindstorm system. Is it Mindstorm? Mindscape?
Mindstorms, yeah.
Yes.
Mindstorm, yeah.
And actually, they just discontinued it, which was really sad. But go on.
Yeah, I was thinking as I was saying this, I feel like I recall that, and that's not happy. But anyway, so the whole thing is retro. It's got an Apple II clone involved, and apparently he was nominated at a Chicago Lego event, the largest I think Lego convention in the country, for the winner of the mechanical category. But he didn't win, and so since then he's created a fully functional four-speed transmission that actually you can see it with a flywheel clutch. You can see it ratchet up its speed dramatically in the demonstration video on the piece that we'll link. And it has reverse, so very impressive. And the aspect to this that's sort of unique to me is he reached out knowing that I live in Northern Virginia. In August, there is a Lego brick, I think it's Brick Fair is the term of the one that's coming to Northern Virginia in August. He's going to be demoing there and showing it, and I hope to go with my daughter and see this and meet Evan. What is unfortunate is that I, looking at the calendar, that may be the day that we're flying back from a college visit in Tennessee with my daughter. So I think we might not actually be able to make it, and that's going to be very sad if that's the case, but I can't seem to find my plans, whether it's the day before or not. So if I go, that'll be a great thing to see, but I fear it might not happen. But anyway, it's an impressive combination of retro Apple II and retro plastic Lego toy goodness. So there you go.
Very cool. Yeah, I think I will actually sort of pre-show one of the eBay picks that I was going to have, which sort of fits into this, which is it's a Apple IIgs setup with the whole sort of Lego logo set of that era. This is actually
like
super
the
complete
units he's using. I think that's the very
really cool
one of those interface units, definitely same era as you said.
That stuff is really rare. So for anyone who isn't familiar with that era of Lego, this is Lego Dacta. Dacta was their education-focused sub-brand, and it was very expensive back in the day. It came with lesson plans and all this other stuff for educators, and that stuff is really, really rare. Like, you don't see it like this, especially with the original storage packaging that it came with and everything. That's amazing.
Yeah, this is one of the best ones I've ever seen. I have a lot of this stuff, but I didn't know how it fit together. You know, it's really kind of neat to see like all of the pieces in their appropriate compartments in the blue briefcase, and all of those little flyers. They have little projects that you can make, and you know, a lot of it really is like, you know, here's the teacher's guide, and
that's amazing.
That's a beautifully complete set indeed. I guess it's the Dacta must be he mentions it in the video, Evan, but I don't I know there were a few different iterations, but he was saying with the one that he's using, I don't know what level of support makes this possible on the Lego side, but you can use apparently basic logo, even assembly language to, you know, control the Lego devices that you've got connected. So that's pretty cool.
There was a board that went in the Apple II that connects to that black box, and it was just a 6522 via. It was really just a serial port basically that you were talking to. So you could talk to it with any number of programs, programming languages. Part of what makes the Dacta stuff so rare is that you couldn't buy it as a consumer. It was only distributed through like education verticals.
Education.
So you had to be like a school board to even get it. And it was also, not a lot of it, I don't think, was sold outside of like Denmark, where it was originally sold. So to see a kit like this out in the wild with all the original packaging and everything, that's really amazing. That stuff is unobtainium.
That's impressive. And I will say, if you look closely in Evan's video at the beginning when he shows the laser, you can just see on the left, he's utilizing the Laser 128's single expansion slot.
Yes.
for that card to interface in, so making it possible. So, wow.
And
yeah.
As an original Lego Technic fan, I appreciate his use of only the early components, the like 70s and 80s Lego Technic, which was really just like a couple of axles, a couple of gears, and the original beam with the holes in it. You know, there were sets, the original Technic sets, there was a bulldozer and a crane. Those were the two original ones. And they're 99% regular Lego bricks with just a couple of special pieces, but they still managed to make it, you know, do a lot of really amazing things. And so that's what he's used for this engine project. Really cool.
Yeah. Yeah. Very impressive.
Mm-hmm. The card, I think we might have mentioned this before, but Alex Lucchesi did sort of a rework of the card. So the card is actually sometimes harder to find than the rest of the stuff, like the box and things. And so he kind of worked out how to make the card. So the on the screen, I'm showing the actual Lego card, which is not much of anything, and he's recreated it. And so it's possible if you have a box but not the card to sort of set this up.
And the irony is, I bet a whole bunch of people bought Apple IIs on eBay that have that card in them, because schools would have unplugged the black box and packaged that separately, not knowing the card inside had to go with it. And then people would buy these Apple IIs from schools and they would have that card in them, and it doesn't look like anything. They wouldn't know what it was, although it does say Lego on it, but they probably tossed it or it's just sitting in their Apple II and they don't know what it is.
Yeah, that's got to be true. I mean, think about it. They're all coming from schools. Wow.
All right. Earl, you have the next thing.
Just a little short blurb. I saw this on Vintage is the New Old, a website that has retro news and links to various articles. Someone named, and I hope I don't butcher the name, Andrea Cucchetto, who was involved with the Atari scene for a long, long time, has made a port of the game Space Taxi, which, as I understand it, was originally on the Commodore 64, although I never played it. I don't think I ever even saw it running on the Commodore 64. I do recognize the name, and I know that it was very popular. Mm. So the Atari port, and I there's a couple reasons why I picked this article. One is I'm just fascinated by this concept lately, and I've seen a number of cases of this with porting games from an 8-bit platform that it was originally released on to another one of the 8-bit platforms in modern day. I think that's awesome, and it is a technical feat. And the second reason is that this looks like a fun game. It actually looks, in a sense, like a manual dexterity nightmare, because you're the pilot of this little taxi sprite, and you have to convey passengers from one spot to another, and you have to dodge things while you're doing it, like bullets and magnets and other little beasties that want to kill you while you're trying to get your passengers around. So I guess not too much different than actual taxi driving. And it looks fun to play. I want to try it. I actually want to try it on the Atari. One of the things that they noted is on the Commodore 64, I guess it had these little digitized audio clips where when the taxi was being summoned to a location, there would be a little scratchy voice that would say, "Hey, taxi," and then tell the taxi the destination they wanted, like pad 3. And they were able to port that over to the Atari. I don't think, other than Sam, maybe, I don't know that I've ever heard digitized voice on the Atari, although it's apparently capable of it, and I don't know if any other games had it, but this one does. So I thought this was neat. I'm going to haul out the Atari 800 and give it a try. It'll run on the Atari 8-bits with 48K or more, so it will... I think the article says it will run on the Atari 800. So I don't know that any of you had Commodore 64s back in the day. Did any of you ever play any incarnation of Space Taxi?
No, I wasn't familiar with this game. I played a lot of C64 games. My best friend in junior high had a C64. I spent a lot of time at his house playing his games, but he did not have this one. So this is news to me.
When I for 2 or 3 years of my life that I was full-time involved in iPhone game review online and news and that sort of thing, an iOS version remake of Space Taxi, the C64, much, you know, very modern, it wasn't seeking to look particularly retro, came out. And to review it, I, you know, grabbed the disk image and was playing the C64 version in an emulator, and I actually got really engrossed in it. I was played hours of Space Taxi on the C64. So, and from what I learned, as Earl says, it was quite popular at the time. But it's fun. I think it's fun. The iOS one was fun. Of course, it's long gone, unsupported, off the store, like most old games that come and go. But yeah. So, and I wonder. This is by Muse Software, who, you know, Castle Wolfenstein, and Wolfenstein had, you know, on the Apple II anyway, it had a digitized voice sample that was kind of jarring and
That's
rather,
right.
Yeah, I was going to say, I was wondering if the Atari version of Wolfenstein had that voice. It sounds like it did. Earl, is that right?
Wolfenstein on the 64 never played
On the Atari. It existed for the Atari 8-bit, correct?
I only ever played Wolfenstein on the Apple II.
Oh, okay. Okay, I see. I was just... Okay, I assumed it was on the Atari, and I wondered if it had that voice, which the Apple II version does, as it's also by Muse.
Does anyone else know? Was there an Atari port of that?
I have no idea. I guess so. Yeah, I'm seeing YouTube videos for them. Castle Wolfenstein for the Atari 8-bit family. I don't know if I will be able to hear the, you know, whatever it is.
I just remember when I would sneak, when I was supposed to be like doing homework or in bed already, I would, you know, sneak and play my Apple IIc, and I think I had just gotten a copy of Wolfenstein, and that loud sample sort of woke up the parents, and it wasn't a good time. So I do remember that.
The voices in that game were really neat. That game has a very, very positive reputation. I never really understood it. It's very, very difficult. It gets credited for a lot of things, including like the first stealth game and the first synthesized voice in a game on the Apple II and various other things. And it's well renowned for being a lot of fun, but I always just found it incredibly difficult.
Yeah. And if you actually, one of the things you have to do is open chests, and the way they simulate the difficulty is making you sit there and wait. So, if you actually, I don't know if it was a sort of a hacked version that I had, or whether it was just always possible to like do something like hit the space bar or whatever to just make the countdown speed by. But if you didn't do that, it wasn't even fun.
Mm-hmm. I feel like there was a sequel, which is either Beyond or Return, whatever the number two sequel was. I feel like they made it a little bit more friendly as far as some of the items in the first. So I did enjoy the second one much more than the first. Mm-hmm. I didn't. So maybe they learned from user testing.
But yeah, that voice sampling was something that I think that Silas Warner, I think, was the one who did that. He wrote something. Oh, was it him? I forget. But he was one of the main Muse people. He wrote a program that would sort of let you sample your voice through the cassette port on the Apple II. So you would stick a microphone in there, or stick a cassette player with a microphone in it, and say your thing for a while. So they published something called The Voice, which allowed you to record your own stuff and use those in basic programs and stuff. So that was in fact, I think, the first, that and Graphics Magician were the first Apple II software things that I ever bought. So I have a fond memory of The Voice, where one of the things they have is a demo of they have a Christmas demo on there. It's very funny. I'll see if I can pull it up, but it's essentially a low res picture of Santa's head, and he says like, and he shouts ho 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 at you, you know, Merry Christmas. It's really quite evil.
Yeah, the effect was so good in Wolfenstein, partly because the voice samples sound so scratchy and violent and angry. Like it's sounds the way that a Nazi guard would yell at you.
Hello. Yeah. But there's Santa. And the red eyes sort of blink, and it's really quite...
It's such an amazing likeness of Santa. I mean, you almost wouldn't know it wasn't real Santa.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mommy, that's not Santa.
This is all very Black Mirror.
Yeah. Okay, let's see. I think I have the next thing. Okay, my thing's actually sort of short, but it's an Ars Technica article on Vince Weaver's missed demake for the Atari 2600. I don't know if people have come across this. But he's been doing sort of these demakes of modern games. He did a missed demake for the Apple II, and he's followed that up with a missed demake for the Atari 2600, which is essentially taking Myst and porting it to this like much less capable computer. but it's one of these kind of like, climbing the mountain because it's there kind of projects, but it is really pretty pleasing. So they've got, in this article, they've got some screenshots comparing, like the actual Mist and what he's got going on the 2600. Looks pretty good to me.
128 colors.
It honestly looks fantastic. It's entirely recognizable and entirely playable, which for the 2600 is really something. Vince does a lot of great demakes. He did Mist for the Apple II as well, and he's done a lot of really great ones. This one is especially ambitious.
Yeah. Let's see. Somewhere there's a link to his Apple II one is actually playable.
Yeah, and his Another World demake for the Apple II is also really amazing. Like that's a masterclass on demaking. He's got a really detailed write up on how all the different steps he went through to try and make everything, recognizable. Like that's always the goal with these extreme demakes, is just to make it recognizable. Like, can you tell what you're looking at, and is it playable and recognizable as the game that it was? And to do that on the 2600 is very impressive.
Yeah, and honestly, I was aware of the Apple II one, but I hadn't actually seen it. And right now, we're playing a video of a playthrough of it, and it's astounding, really.
Yeah. It really is. Yeah.
Anyway, so check that out, and I think at this point, the Atari 2600 one is still in progress, so it's not playable like the Apple II one is. But keep an eye out for that. For your Atari 2600 emulation adventures. Okay, let's see. We can move on. That was all I had to say about that, I guess. And Quinn, you have the next thing.
Yeah. So what I've got here is it's a project called Petsky BBS Builder. And this is a really neat thing if you're interested in BBSs and Petsky in particular. So it's a Java framework for building the, if you will, server side of a BBS. So it runs on any modern Mac, PC, Linux, whatever, because it's all Java. And you just build and run this thing, and it sets up a Petsky BBS that you can then dial into with your VIC-20 or your Commodore 64 or what have you. And what I like about it is that it's very much written as an SDK. So it's easy to extend. You can build, he's got libraries for building door games, for building menus, for building ASCII art. So it's very, very extensible and expandable, but it's also easy to use. When you just build it and run it, you automatically get like a Hello World BBS that just will start up and work. And then from there, you can start adding games and file areas and bulletin boards and whatever else you want to it. So this is, it's really neat. If you want to play with BBSs, this just feels like a really low barrier to entry way to do it. I think like a lot of us, I was always fascinated with the idea of writing my own BBS, and I even took a couple of swings at it in BASIC, like I'm sure many of us did. I also played with GBBS software back in the day, but never actually ran one. So this is a little bit of a taste of that. Certainly to have had something like this back in the day would have been really cool. So there you go. That's the Petsky BBS project. I don't know how you connect to it. He makes a lot of mention of TCP/IP, so I assume this is like a Telnet situation. Like you have to have one of those Wi-Fi modems or one of those Telnet BBS devices for the actual Commodore that you want to dial into this thing with. So I assume that's a prerequisite. But otherwise, so we'll link to the GitHub in the show notes, which is where you can download the code and download all the samples and everything, and he gives you lots and lots of, there's lots of documentation here on how to set it up and how to expand it and how to add your own door games and so on.
Very cool. All right. Earl, you have the next item.
I have some, believe it or not, late-breaking news. This first part isn't late-breaking. Antic just celebrated their 10-year anniversary as a podcast, and we wanted to give them a shout-out. Congratulations, Antic. That is awesome. Love that podcast, and I love the fact that they've been so consistent for such a long time. So, but the late-breaking part of this is that in that 10-year celebration episode, I think that's where this got started. They talked about AI, and they talked about training AI to be able to write Atari BASIC. And now over on the Antic Discord, there's actually a channel dedicated to an effort. And Jason Moore is jumping in and looks like leading a group of enthusiasts on this. And we know Jason Moore from AtariProjects.org, that awesome website that has a whole bunch of bite-sized Atari projects that you can go over and walk through to have fun things to do with your Atari. So I asked the group if it would be okay to mention this on the RCR, and I just got the reply. They said yes, and I asked them for a little blurb. Anyway, Jason says the goal is to develop a large language model like ChatGPT specifically for writing Atari BASIC code. We'll gather as many training examples as we can, hundreds, they hope, with annotations, and then build the model and make it open source. And they think that a large language model trained just specifically on Atari BASIC will be more accurate and better. And he says, I plan to set up a GitHub for the project to post the code collection and the eventual model. And I've been having a lot of fun with AI myself recently, AI image generation, speech generation, etc., and playing around with that. And I thought creating a large language model like a ChatGPT specifically for Atari was an awesome idea. So I just wanted to throw that out there. They're working on that, and I think it's fun. And I'm anxious, actually, to see what comes of this.
But think of all the Atari programming jobs that we'll lose.
That we'll lose, right. Think of the economic impact of this. Yeah, there will be an Atari programmer strike, I think, coming any day now.
And you had another one, actually, Quinn, that was in here.
I did, yeah. I was going to wait my turn, but I can do both. Let's see here.
I think there's no one else has a thing in between, I don't think.
All right. Yeah, these were both short items, so I threw in two. So the second one is exactly my kind of weird project. So this ties in earlier in the show. We were talking about those dedicated word processors, which were this weird middle bridge technology in the early 90s for people who were very late adopters to computers but wanted something better than a typewriter. There were these all-in-one word processors that were generally looked kind of like a Tandy Model 100, those Radio Shack portable computers. So it's a keyboard and usually a small screen, sometimes just a line, an alphanumeric line, but also sometimes like a four or five lines. This article is about one called the AlphaSmart Dana, which actually had a little bit of a bitmap display on it, about like 2 inches high and maybe 8 inches wide. Monochrome. So these were a weird little bridge technology, but they had real computer hardware in them. And in fact, this particular one has a 68000 in it. So here you've got a device that has a 68000 in it and has a bitmap display. It can theoretically run an Atari ST operating system. So that's what this person did, is they managed to get Atari ST's GEM operating system running on this early 90s word processing device. And it doesn't run well, as you can imagine, but it does in fact run. And you have to start by hacking up the hardware in order to get it installed. So you have to use the debug port to get access to the EEPROM where the software for this thing lives. And then he's taken an open source port of the Atari ST operating system called MUTOS, I'm not sure. But there's an open source version of the Atari ST operating system, including the GEM GUI, and he's taken that and modified it as needed to port it to this weird word processing device. So there's not a ton of info on it here, but the code is all here, and there is a video demonstrating how to hack the hardware to get access to the EEPROM, and he's got instructions on how to upload the code, and then he's got a series of videos that also demonstrate it kind of in action. So, link to all this in the show notes. It's definitely one of those things where I am never going to do it, and I'm sure none of our listeners are ever going to do it, but it's really cool to see that someone did it, and definitely another one of those because the mountain was there sort of projects. Someone looked at this thing and said, huh, there's a 68,000 in this. I wonder. And here we are.
Nice.
That's really cool.
I wonder the I can see from this you in the on the live stream you scrub through the video and yeah. I see on the initial screen it looks like it's the Dana device by default is using some sort of a Palm OS based operating system. It looks like Palm.
Yeah, it interface. Could be. It could. Yeah, it probably likely. Has
a, yeah, it probably has a. That would mean it has a Dragon Ball, which is a 68,000 CPU.
Yeah, or, actually, I think that's right.
Yeah, but I wonder. I was. Does he actually? You say it has a bit of a bitmap display, obviously with the little icons and graphics from the Palm piece. Is he actually rendering the desktop on the display on the unit itself, or is it going out to an external display?
I believe he's running it on the device entirely.
Okay. Nice. Interesting.
This blog post that I linked to doesn't show it, but I got this from a Hackaday article, which did show basically a very compressed version of GEM on the screen of the device.
Oh, nice. Yeah. Nice. That's awesome. I am and was a big Atari ST guy in the past, and I've got an ST to my left, and that's really cool.
Yeah, so. It's one of those projects where I wish the documentation or presentation of it was a little bit better. It's all we've got here is a very light blog post and then some links outwards to like his fork of the Atari ST OS and some other things, and then a YouTube video of how to get access to the hardware, but there's not a lot more info than that.
I wish there was a nice photo of the thing rendered just running GEM.
I think there is. If you go to his YouTube channel, he's got more videos about this project. The one on his blog post is just like the blog post is sort of like, hey, if you want to do this, here are the instructions for getting it running yourself. But I think elsewhere he has videos on how he actually did it. I'll see if I can dig that up. But it's
very interesting. Yeah. So I somehow had never internalized this. That Palm was using a 68,000. I mean, I knew the word Dragon Ball, but I didn't know that was a flavor of 68,000.
Yeah, SoC was 68,000. Yeah, I think it's 16. It's either 16 or 32 megahertz. It's actually twice as fast as the 68,000 that we first encountered with the ST and the Mac and the Amiga. I think it's at least 16 megahertz, but it's not much more. I think it's 16 megahertz. Yeah.
In this blog post it says this one is a 32 megahertz Dragon Ball
PC. Okay.
So as we were going here, I was sort of like searching around my immediate vicinity to try to figure out where my Dana is, but somewhere I do have one of these. But the reason I got it was for its Palm history. It's kind of the best Palm in the end. I mean, it's got all the space, it's got a full keyboard. The one I have has a wireless, it's sort of able to connect to the world, and it works fine for Palm stuff. It's black and white, but
I imagine it runs most Palm software, right? Like you could just install things that aren't Dana specific. It's a straight up Palm device, right?
Yeah, it's kind of the successor to a series of machines. I think they're by the company or called Alpha Smart. And so those are sort of like smart keyboards. Like there's a Alpha Smart keyboard for the 2GS.
The ADB.
That you can use. Yeah. And so that, I guess basically you can sort of like type in it. It can remember things that you've typed and then feed it back to your 2GS and so forth. There were a couple of these things.
Okay.
Yeah, sort of in-class note takers and that kind of stuff.
Yeah,
so I dug
into his YouTube channel. So he has a 13 video series on reverse engineering the Alpha Smart Dana from soup to nuts. And towards the end of the 13th video, he shows the Atari ST OS running on it. So if you look in the top left corner, you'll see the Atari logo because this is GEM.
Yeah.
This is a GEM word processor running on the device.
He's running first word, so you can basically use the Atari ST word processor instead of the Dana's built-in word processor.
Which is sort of hilarious. Yeah, you're running an emulated Atari ST operating system on this thing. It's just you can run a word processor, which of course is what it was doing natively.
That's great.
It's a very deep series. His YouTube channel is kind of neat. He's got a lot of very similar things. He's done a bunch of reverse engineers on these weird 90s word processors. He's also done reverse engineering of other kind of gray zone hardware that we've talked about, things like the Tiger Learning Computer, which is sort of like an Apple II under the hood that's secret. There's a lot of those types of devices in the world that are secretly something else underneath, like this is secretly a Palm device underneath. He seems to have a penchant for those. So he's got a bunch of videos on his channel of finding those in the wild and reverse engineering them and revealing the true hardware that's underneath them and getting them to do other things. So kind of neat stuff.
That is really cool. Huh.
Oh, here we go. So this device has a pen. So I guess he's modified the Atari OS to work with the pen instead of the mouse. So yeah, there's a nice screenshot of the Atari ST desktop running on this tiny screen, and then he's using the pen to interact with it, which is pretty cool. He's explaining many of the challenges that were involved in getting the pen to work as the mouse and so on.
I wonder what the resolution of that screen is.
It looks pretty decent.
Video. Yeah, it does.
I mean, just looking at it, it looks like maybe like 640 by 200 or something. It's not bad.
Right. Yeah, I want one. I wish I hadn't seen this.
Yeah.
I haven't even taken my Naboo out of the box yet, and here it is.
Wow. Yeah, I think it probably runs at whatever kind of like native Palm resolution is, because I think it's kind of organized in three.
Yeah.
It's kind of like three Palms side by side. Yeah. Okay. So like un-Dana-ized applications just kind of run in the middle.
Third. Oh, interesting. Okay. Interesting. I didn't know that. That's the same way that the original iPad worked. The iPad, the screen is treated as when you're in portrait mode, it's treated as three iPhone screens across, basically.
Mm-hmm.
And nowadays it's more abstracted than that, but the original iPad, that's how they got backward compatibility with all the iPhone apps, is they tricked it into thinking it was running in a third of the screen, basically.
I know I didn't like it when app developers didn't make iPad versions and, you know, suddenly you had all these like monster pixels.
Yeah, the first gen, it was pretty bad.
All right, I think we made it through our items of interest in news. I think we can move now to a word from our sponsor.
Some people buy an IBM personal computer to manage their finances. But after spending $1,355, what finances are left to manage? Others think one of those tiny computers will do. Fine, for storing a few phone numbers and recipes for Nestle Road Pie. There's a choice between spending too much or getting too little computer. The Commodore 64 gives you as much memory as the IBM at less than half the cost. Commodore computers, in more homes than any other home computer.
Are you worried about the $20,000 you've got in the commodities market?
No.
Are you worried about a corporate takeover?
No.
Are you worried about going bald?
Nope, not yet.
Are you worried about a floppy disk losing all your accounts receivable?
No. No. I'm not worried.
If you had 3M diskettes, you wouldn't have to worry. 3M floppies are certified 100% error-free. No floppies more reliable. 3M diskettes. One less thing to worry about.
I see by your job application, you've scored 6 million on the video game Munchman.
Yeah?
And I see you shot down 2 billion aliens from the planet Mongo.
Yeah.
You are good at computer games. So what do you know about computers?
If you're going to spend your time playing video games, why not play them on something that can also teach you about computing? Get a Commodore 64 or VIC 20. It's tough to grow up in a computer age without learning about computers.
And we're back. And now is time for the host retrocomputing gift idea. And I was kind of looking around for just something that would seem sort of related. And I came up with a totally awesome USB mouse that you can buy on Etsy for $17. It's probably terrible.
But
it is a little turtle.
That's cute. It sort of looks like he's puking the mouse cord, though.
Yep. Mm-hmm. It might be better than having the mouse cord come out the other end, I suppose.
That's true.
Maybe he's eating it. He's like on the way.
Yeah, it does kind of look like he's eating it. And it literally goes into his mouth like a big piece of spaghetti. That's pretty funny.
Go. Oh, and there's a pink one. Oh, that's a pink turtle. Well, yes, they're both turtles.
That's rose red.
Rose red. Okay.
You could put two of them together and they could have their little Lady and the Tramp moment.
Yeah, yep. That's exactly what I was thinking, the spaghettis, yes, indeed.
So the thing is, there are actually green turtles. I don't know that I've ever seen a red turtle.
Yep. Let's just so you don't confuse it with real turtles.
Right.
A high-vis turtle.
I should have mentioned when I was describing the miasmatic weather outside, I experienced it by my wife and daughter and I, we went over to there's a park with a turtle pond, and we saw a great many turtles, including baby turtles about the size of a silver dollar. I can't believe mention that until now. It's with our logo piece.
What color were they?
looked pretty close
Rose
to black,
rat,
the baby ones, but yeah, I didn't see any red ones, and they weren't chewing spaghetti. But lots of turtles.
Excellent. All right, so once you're done, you know, buying however many turtles you want at $17 each, we can turn our attention to eBay. And Blake, you have the first of our eBay auctions.
Okay, so the first item for me, there's an IBM keyboard. I'm actually a bit of a keyboard aficionado. I am fans of mechanical keyboards and all the different types of key switches. I enjoy varying the keyboard I use. I've got many in a box, and I rotate some through the office and that kind of thing. There's mechanical switches, dome switches. And so this is a IBM 736-2149-83 key beam spring keyboard. And so I had never heard of this, actually. Beam spring sounded like it had to do with the technology behind the key switches, which is something that, you know, has my interest. And so I dug around a little bit into it, and this is attached to IBM, you know, mini mainframe computers, that sort of thing, using a switch technology called the beam spring. And what it is, I'm sure it sounds like the mechanical keyboard thing is becoming a little more mainstream. I don't know if people generally, you know, have any idea about the technology in it. I know IBM had they're very well known for, with the PC and the AT, they had the very clacky, clicky, heavy keyboards that use buckling spring technology. Whether you're aware of or not, it was a very unique sort of key switch technology that caused the clack and the activation, and it had a nice satisfying feel, and it was very, very annoying audibly to anyone working within about 30 yards of you. I've been asked to take my buckling spring keyboard home at three different jobs, so I keep that at the house. At any rate, it's a very nice keyboard. But this, the beam spring preceded the buckling spring keyboard. This was what IBM used for their keyboards, for their minis and various systems, right up until the buckling spring landed. And I think it landed just before the IBM PC came out. But basically, what makes it a little bit interesting is it is a capacitive keyboard technology. And what that means is there's somewhere in the switch, there is a sort of a conductor that has a certain charge, and something else touches it and it changes the capacitance, it changes the charge state. And the advantage of this is, theoretically, you know, you can implement it without having any moving parts, as far as something just has to touch. So the actual switch itself can last a great deal of time. When you touch your iPhone screen or your Android screen, I mean, you're changing the capacitance of the state of the screen, and that's a capacitance interaction. Capacitive interaction. And so it's just a technology that is not used very frequently. One of my favorite keyboards, I'm digging among photos of some of the keyboards I have, is it's a key switch, I believe from Korea, called the Topre key switch, and it also is capacitive. And the little keyboard I picked up actually has the scientific formula, or the equation for capacitance printed onto the edge of the keyboard, just to so you can show off that you can drop that heavy capacitance swag vibe to all your office workers, and they'll know that you're rolling in a different manner. But anyway, so I thought it would be interesting. I think these are fairly rare. I mean, they're old, and I don't know what you'd play. You'd have to create an interface. I'm sure someone has created a Raspberry Pi interface for this to other systems, but it's kind of this unit is a sort of at a hefty $1,199, $1,200 price. Looks like the seller was selling five of them. So anyway, it's out of Wisconsin if you wanted it. Delivery fee varies, but it's a little bit of piece of history, but the key switch name caught my eye, and I'm one of those keyboard nerds. So there you go. That was my one and only eBay item for this show, I think. So there you go.
Yeah, I think the keyboard nerds do are willing to spend a lot to buy these keyboards. It's pretty common to see them at pretty high prices. This, by the way, is the that keyboard in context.
Oh, so nice.
With the 5251 behind it, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, what makes me sad, and there's some keyboard on Masto and other social networks. I've got the my retro folks that I chat with, and then I have a few keyboard nerds that it's a different group. But something that is heavily lamented by many of them who are very, very deeply financially into this hobby are when, some of these systems, someone will separate the keyboard from a system and sell it directly for use on a PC or something like that with an adapter. For instance, one of the most prized keyboards, it's considered to be one of the best feeling keyboards ever made. And it's very nice looking blue. So it has multiple tones, blues, unique keycaps. It's the keyboards that went with Symbolics Lisp machines. Like, these are size of mini fridges there are some retro folks online that I know are running these machines at their house for fun, writing code and using them as retro systems. But someone will see this cool keyboard on what, I guess in some warehouse somewhere, if there's a big computer that looks like it's of course of no use to anyone anymore, and so they'll pull the keyboard off, and without, you've basically caused that computer to be unusable if it was not failed in and of itself. So it always makes me sad to see like a singleton, here's the Symbolics keyboard for this unit, and you can just go to the store and buy an adapter to use it with your USB system, because somewhere out there is a Lisp machine is not going to ever get used because of the scarcity of these keyboards. So that's not a happy thing. But anyway,
very actually one of the things that I was thinking about exactly when I was thinking about keyboard aficionados is that, there are sort of pluses and minuses to being a keyboard aficionado. If you get a computer just to get the keyboard and then ditch the rest of the computer or separate
it. Sure. I mean, for my part, I've typically gone after keyboards that are sold, as keyboards. I'm not reaching into some of the, on the live stream, Paul is showing this sort of holy grail of keyboards, the nice blue, gray, and white Symbolics keyboards. But you see these come across on eBay, and then you can picture that Symbolics system that's just sitting there, unable to be used, because that's obviously not a standard interface. And then there are specific keys. One of the interesting things about these systems that were made specifically for RISC development and RISC environment, not RISC, I keep saying RISC, Lisp. Have I been saying RISC the entire time? Lisp. Yeah. Lisp. You need these extra keys. You can't really easily use them on a regular keyboard attached to it.
So there's the key that has both I and the infinity symbol, or otherwise known perhaps as the mosquito key.
Yes, the mosquito key. I know some shame mails often will get sent to sellers that are holding on to this, or maybe asking, could you please, is there any way you you know, talk about a different arrangement, you know, where did this come from kind of thing. So, but yes, I've not personally gotten involved, and I don't have any interest in trying to harvest, you know, pieces from other systems, but yes, I will, my madness for keyboards. I mean, I've spent like $500 on a small, it's called a 10 keyless keyboard, a tiny keyboard that doesn't even have visible cursor keys, but feels nice. And so obviously there's something wrong with me. But yeah, so yeah, leave the old keyboards attached to their, yeah, thumbs up, thumbs down.
Symbolics keyboard has a very forward thinking thumbs up and thumbs down.
Yeah, it's got built in Facebook buttons.
Dedicated.
Yep. Uh-huh. It's even like the same icon. It's got the little shirt cuff in the icon and everything.
Yep.
Is there like a little cat emoji or
the hamburger
key
icon on the B key?
Mm-hmm. There are some interesting glyphs.
Yeah.
There's a super key, a hyper key.
And the Roman numerals, if you're feeling really retro.
I think we've talked about this before, but like old VT100 and related terminals, their keyboards are fascinating because there weren't really any standards yet. And so they have all kinds of crazy things on them. Just keys that you have no idea what the intended use case was. Crazy colors, all that sort of thing.
I guess if your colleague sends you an email that just hits you in the absolute wrong way, you can punch that rub out button and end them.
Right. And if he really, really didn't like it, you could use the hyper rub out or super rub out combination.
or meta rub out if you were just kidding.
Right.
Yeah.
Excellent.
And there's the key that just says Greek.
Yep.
Exactly. You push that when you don't understand something. Just it's Greek to me. I don't know.
Yeah. Anyway. But yep. So there you go.
Excellent. All right. Earl, you have the next item.
I do. So my eBay auction is a cartridge that you put in a Commodore 64. And it gives you an IEEE 488 interface, which is the drive interface that was used on the PET and CBM and some of the other series of Commodore computers. And you might think, why would I want to do this? Blake alluded earlier that there are people from the 80s who are still waiting to load a game on their 1541 disk drive. And so this would allow you to plug in a faster, better, and in a lot of cases, more spacious PET CBM disk drive to your Commodore 64. Now, I was aware there were third-party products that did this, but I wasn't aware that Commodore had actually made their own interface for this. So I went and did some digging, found out that, yes, they did. They're very rare. And I think the person selling it in this auction doesn't even know whether or not it's operational because they don't have a drive to test it with. The starting bid is $200, and my wild guess is that it's going to go significantly higher than that. And I think if I were the one buying this, which I won't be, that I would be getting it as a collector's item for the absolute completionist who wants to, you know, want to make sure they have every single thing Commodore ever did, then you might want to have one of these, but don't buy it to use it because for a couple of reasons. One is the mass storage devices that are out there modern day speak Jiffy DOS, and there are better ways to get a faster disk drive if you're just after functionality. And the second is if you really wanted to connect an old PET or CBM drive, I believe that there's at least one place selling cards that you can buy today that will connect your Commodore 64 to an IEEE drive. But I thought this was neat. I think it looks cool. It's this black plastic. I've always loved this particular Commodore aesthetic design, kind of what you saw in the Commodore 16, which is a little bit more obscure entry in the Commodore line. So it's black plastic, a blue Commodore, the word Commodore, and then the standard chicken lips logo in a dark, dark theme.
I'm also a sucker. Anytime devices have the little barn doors for like vertical slots, like cartridge ports and stuff.
Oh, that's the other thing I should mention. It goes in the cartridge slot, but they say that certain cartridges will still work with the cartridge extender that comes out the top. That looks very much like the, like you say, Quinn, the barn door sort of thing. The SX64 portable version of the 64 has that same sort of cartridge insertion mechanism. I wouldn't count on every cartridge working, because I'm sure that the interface for this must suck up some of the hardware addresses or whatever that would render some cartridges non-functional. But again, they're not even sure if this works. I think this is primarily a collector's item, but I thought it was neat.
There's some potential for interesting experiments here, because that interface, that IEEE 488 interface, was used for a lot of other stuff at the time. Like, it was, you know, a standard on oscilloscopes, and like HP calculators used it. And so there's probably some weird forbidden love children that you could make with your Commodore 64 and a 70s HP oscilloscope or something with one of these things.
I have this vague recollection. I don't know if this is right, but I could swear I remember Chuck Peddle talking about doing that on purpose with the prospect of being able to connect the Commodore equipment to test equipment and have that be an inexpensive solution for control, because in other cases, the computing equipment that you could connect up to that interface back in the day was just exorbitantly expensive.
Yeah, I believe it.
There was an Apple II card that would connect to that interface as well.
Oh, wow.
I think that's a fairly difficult to find card. At least it was difficult for me to find. But I have but one. I am sort of interested to see if it could be connected to like a Commodore drive or something like that. I don't have a Commodore drive, but anyway.
Well, I think there's also some special protocol. In addition to just the electrical interface, there is the protocol, the DOS, that you need to be able to emulate if you wanted to do that. And maybe you could do that in software. I'm not sure.
Another mountain that's there.
I see. I was just looking into some of the details. It looks like, I guess, HP designed it, as you mentioned, for measuring equipment, logic analyzers, multimeters, and there's mention of various protocols on the Wikipedia page. But interesting. Looks like quite a piece to add to one's Commodore collection.
And I think one of the reasons that people wanted to get these was for BBSs. I remember hearing a couple of different people mention that they wanted the IEEE interface for both the speed and the fact that they could get higher capacity disk units that they could connect up to it and have more wide open spaces for their BBS users.
I assume it would be the case that a PET drive connected to this wouldn't, you couldn't read a standard Commodore floppy disk. Would that be correct?
You mean like a 64 disk?
Yeah, like a 64 disk. Maybe you could. I was assuming that wouldn't be possible.
Well, the 64 drives had the 6502 in them doing a bunch of work, and I wonder if the PET drives were also similarly smart.
I believe they're also smart devices.
Okay.
I think there's enough differences in the disk formatting itself that you couldn't read it. I don't know if you could with third-party software. That'd be something interesting to go check out. I don't know that.
But yeah, as you say, if you're running a BBS, though, all you want is some place to store data and bigger space and faster. So I could totally see that. Back in the day, obviously, there's, as you say, easier ways to do it today.
It would certainly be technically possible to read the 64 disks on a PET drive, assuming they're both GSM, both GCM, or both MFM, as long as the flux is compatible and the drives operate the same on that level, then everything else above that is software. So much like, Macs can read PC disks if you have enough of the right software on them. So that's probably doable. Someone probably has written such a utility for the 64 back in the day for, like you said, BBSs and such. They probably had a C64 disk reader for pet drives, I would guess.
Maybe so. Interesting.
All right. Let's see, I guess. Am I next? I am next, I think. I, as usual, have a bunch of different things, and I will probably skip through them quickly. Here was one that I just thought was kind of interesting. It's a Sinclair Memotech ZX81 keyboard. So the ZX81 has a terrible keyboard, and this is a thing that will help you. It plugs into the back, and actually also has an extender so that you can plug something else into it. So it just sort of passes through. I think it kind of looks nice. The Memotech stuff always did kind of look pleasing.
Yeah, that's neat looking, actually. I like that thing.
And the ZX81 has very overloaded keys.
Yeah.
And they're all printed here on the physical keys that you can press. So.
Yeah, Clive Sinclair figured out that if you put 4 operations or 6 operations on every single key, then you need 20% fewer keys, which then saves you 58 cents per unit or something. So yeah, the keyboards on those are ridiculous.
Yep. Anyway, that's a current bid of $56. I haven't seen a lot of these, so I think they're moderately uncommon. We talked about the logo thing, the 2GS with the Lego logo set.
That people should look at that link just for that photo. That photo is beautiful. Like that's,
yeah.
Maybe I'm biased as both a GS fan and a Lego fan, but everything in this photo is just unobtainium. Just amazing to see it all like that.
Yeah. So it's listed as a buy it now of $1,500. And that sounds like a lot, but I'm not sure that it's too far away from what this is worth.
That includes the GS though, right? So that's cheap. Yeah, that's honestly cheap for all that. Like, I don't know, shipping might be a nightmare, but that's honestly extremely reasonable for how rare that stuff is and how good condition it all seems to be in.
I wonder if it doesn't ship. You may have to go to Madison to get it. Yeah, you have to go to Madison, Wisconsin.
Okay, that's probably
so.
That's a lot to do with the low price, probably. He's probably had it. It may have been listed before, and he's having trouble finding someone to come and get it.
Yeah. The reason I have the logo stuff that I have was someone who had basically taken the 2E lab home when they dismantled it. And, so as a condition of taking the logo stuff, I had to take like 8 2Es.
Still worth it.
Yeah. I thought this was kind of funny. I was looking for things related to 1967, this came up. It is a book called How to Build a Working Digital Computer, and the photos on the front, the front cover has sort of a picture of it, and it seems to be kind of built out of things that you have around the house. So a major component of all of this is paper clips. So it shows you how to sort of do various digital computing projects, but the parts list is, it's like a bunch of things and then like 16 large paper clips.
That's awesome. So, yeah, that's dowels, wow. That list is neat. That's all stuff that you can literally buy at a hardware store.
Yeah, huh. And so it does stuff like add numbers together and things like that. I mean, it's kind of neat to learn computing process through this. And so I'm not sure that the eBay auction itself that was connected to this is interesting, but the existence of the book kind of is.
It reminds me of a Radio Shack kit that I got when I was a kid. That was the first thing I ever owned that said that it was a computer. Mm-hmm. And it was a digital computer in the sense that you had lights and switches, and they taught you how to wire the switches in such a way where you would simulate AND gates or OR gates.
Mm-hmm.
It was a bunch of, I think, something like 8 or 10 8-pole double throw switches that you could cross wire to each other and then connect them to indicator lamps. And the bottom line was, with that, of course, if you wired it in one way where throwing either switch would turn on the light, that was an OR gate. If you wired it where it had to go through both switches in order to turn on. That was an AND gate. And you could make some simple games, like I think they had a tic-tac-toe even or something like that, that you could play with just switches and wires and lights connected in such a way where logic gates were simulated. And there's no reason you couldn't have done that with paperclips.
Right.
Actually. And it would have taught you digital logic. So that is cool.
Oddly enough, at the end of the Radio Shack thing, gave up and said the only winning move is not to play. Anyway, yeah, I thought this was pretty funny, though. The digital computer with paperclips. This is a short little series on retro hardware that looked like Homer Simpson.
What have they done to that drive?
It's a Commodore 1541 drive that has yellowed tremendously in the drive part, and then bleached somehow the like whole rest of it. So,
well, or that front mechanism was just a different plastic composition than the rest of the case.
Did 1541s ever come in white, like maybe the 64C drives or something?
I actually have a 1541 that looks just like this.
Oh, okay.
Without the yellowing.
Okay, so they haven't done something to the brown plastic to make it white. They did actually come in white.
Yes, there was one of these.
Okay.
In that color.
That makes more sense.
Kind of like every now and then you see a, like with keyboards, there'll be like that space bar. It's completely yellow because apparently they will often use a different grade of plastic for it for reasons. And the rest of the keys are normal. I don't know. Maybe that's what's going on here.
That happened on my SX64. The rest of the keys are, a lot of the Petsky characters are worn off, but the keys are still beige. But the space bar itself is a horrific kind of yellow like this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
When you see one that's this yellowed, I always wonder, like, what happened to it? Like, you poor thing. Like, was it sitting directly in front of, a very bright window its entire life? Or was it, was it running in a tanning salon? Like, how did it get that much UV that did that to it?
Yeah.
Yeah. Actually, looking at the logo and branding on it, it is distinct, I think, from the brown ones. Like, I don't think the brown ones had that gray bar or that particular sort of font for the Commodore.
Yeah. Yeah, this is definitely a classier kind of look than the original.
Yeah.
It's also possible the yellowing is not as bad as it looks here. As always with yellowing, the automatic white balance on cameras does very weird things to it in photos. So the camera may have white balanced on the off-white plastic of the outer case, which then made the yellow look worse or something along those lines.
And it looks like the, looking closely at the Chicken Lips logo, it looks like maybe they didn't yet pull off that, the plastic, the little clear cellophane cover. You can see kind of bubbling. So you get the, buy it for the experience of freeing the item to the atmosphere. But, and I think I have a 1541. I have not had much time with any 8-bit Commodore, but I do have a 1541 and a 64C, but later they went to that squarish look, right, Earl, with the lever that rotates. So this
you
must
probably
have been
the 1541-2.
Oh, which... yes. That's, yes.
Yeah, I've got a 1571 that has that later design with the lever arm and the square.
I had a 71 once. Yeah, okay.
And the power supply is different too on the 71. It has a built-in power supply, so it takes a power cord directly into it as opposed to having an external power brick. So it's actually
a long unit, long physical drive.
The 1571, I think, is actually a little shorter than the original 1541, comically long. Yeah, the 1571 is a really nice drive, honestly. It's reasonably compact and has everything built into it. It's just got a nice on switch on the back, so it's a pretty nice drive.
And being able to do GCR and MFM makes it pretty versatile also.
Yeah, and it's got like a DOS built into it. So on a Commodore 128, it's got like DOS functions. Like there's like a little menu of stuff that it will do for you, like quickly loading programs and stuff. This when you use it with a 64, you don't get that stuff. But yeah, I happen to have the manual for my 71, so I was reading up on all this stuff. It's kind of neat. So it has like a little bit of a program launcher and stuff built into like the ROM of the 1571 itself.
Right. So I guess it's read CPM.
Yeah, it saves you a bunch of like loading $8, 1 and all that kind of stuff over and over.
Nice.
Yes, much more interesting than why I brought it up. But here's the I guess I have a couple of these. These are my other Homer Simpson exhibits. It's a Quadra. I think this one is a Parmax 7100. No, this one's a Quadra 650, and this one is a Parmax 7180. Both of them have, they're pretty much the same design. They have a plastic front panel and then a metal body. And so the metal body stays unchanged and the plastic front turns yellow.
Yes, I wonder, every machine Apple gave three different names, and I wonder if the yellowing changes per name, because I don't know what else the difference is. Apple's naming scheme at this time was just insane, like literal madness. Ridiculous.
Quadra, this particular Power one Max. Is the Power Max 7180. The other one was a Quadra 650. And both of those were, that, like, I have fondness for both of those specific, you know, arrays of numbers, because those were mine. You know, they may be just numbers, but they were my numbers. So I had the Quadra 650, and I upgraded to the Power Max 7180, and I was sad about it for a while because it was running slower than my Quadra 650 used to be. But anyway.
And don't forget the performance, which overlap.
Oh, yeah. Centris.
Centris, Performas, Quadra. I mean,
yeah, I had the Centris. They all look very similar. AV.
Right.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I was as hardcore a Mac fan as anyone in the 90s, and I never understood their product line. Like, if your own hardcore fans can't figure out what the differences between these 58 different models are, then maybe it's time to cut back your product line.
I'm sure that's one of the first things, like, Steve Jobs walked in there and was like, all right, look, where is that guy? Like, I want to drag him out
slate.
Here.
And he's like, we sell iMacs now. You can get it in six
on the
colors.
Floor right there.
That was his whole thing.
That was one of his best moves. I mean, I was looking from afar because I hadn't used a Mac in some years. And I, like, what's going on over there? I'd go in CompUSA or something, and I'd see these two. Are they the same? And it's just...
Well, that's the thing.
Like a special number just for one store.
They had completely different numbered models that came in the same cases.
Right.
So, like, this case that we're looking at on the screen with the floppy drive above and the CD-ROM below, that exact case had six different models in it. So you didn't even know which one you were looking at by looking at it. Yeah.
Yeah, my girlfriend had a Performa. I was like, wait a minute, but that looks the same as in the lab at school. They've got one, but the disk drive isn't quite as rounded. I don't know. It's just very weird. And I don't know. Very poor at the time, in my opinion.
Okay, let's see. Is this interesting? Maybe it's interesting. I just came across this, and it's a little bit unusual to find such a example of this. It is the controller, which is a super early Apple software product for various financial things around business software. Comes on 7 million discs.
Wow.
And has this binder. It isn't actually 7 million. I'm not sure exactly.
That's a lot of discs, though. There's got to be 20 there.
Yeah,
I think it is about that. Yeah.
Wow.
And it's a really nice package. I mean, like, it has the actual original box. You can really see the kind of like 1978-ness of this, or whatever it was, whenever the disk drive was introduced. It has all the manuals, all the discs, the warranty forms and things.
This is an amazing package. I have never heard of this product. And to see all of it, like in the original shipping box and everything, that's incredible.
Yeah. So they're asking a fair amount for it. It is $430, but it's one of the best. It's probably the best I've ever seen. If you wanted to recreate the photo from the, you know, early Apple marketing, this is the thing you'd need to do it.
That manual is in mint condition. Like, there isn't a mark on it. It looks brand new.
Yeah.
That's amazing. So what's on all of these disks? Is it like there's an accounting thing and an accounts receivable? And like, is it just a bunch of different business programs or?
I am not really sure, to be honest. I mean, so we can see, this one disk that's on the screen says the controller 1.1 general ledger sys 002. So general ledger is at least one of the components.
Right. Okay.
But I think it is that sort of thing that would have accounts receivable and payable and that right. kind of stuff.
Okay. Does this pre or post date VisiCalc?
It should predate it, I think. I can't quite see the copyright date, but
I feel like there would be some overlap in functionality there, so I wondered if this somehow influenced VisiCalc or if this was prescient of it in some way, because somewhere in all of those disks there must be something like a spreadsheet, like a ledger or something.
Was there? I see there's a picture of the back of the binder that you flipped across. Mm-hmm. Was there a date on that? Oh no, just the address.
Yeah, and I'm sort of digging around in another window to try to see if I can find the date on it. But it's going to be probably like 78.
Wow, that's interesting. I've never heard of this package before. I'd love to see some screenshots of it.
Okay. So anyway, so I thought that was interesting. Another interesting thing that showed up. This is, you know, also sort of VisiCalc related, I guess. It's personal software's Your Blood Pressure for the Apple II. My note on this was pairs well with VisiCalc. But it's a personal software cassette that, you know, they did other things besides VisiCalc. I'm not actually sure. Yeah, I guess this is for the Apple II. I knew personal software had done like chess programs and backgammon programs and stuff. I had not actually ever seen this before.
Actually just finished that chapter in Lane Nooney's book. Personal Software was sort of an early publisher. And so they, before VisiCalc, like just before VisiCalc, they were going around like buying up every hobbyist weird thing they could find and throwing it in a box and selling it. So yeah, they had Microchess was probably their biggest pre-VisiCalc success, but they had a bunch of weird stuff like this that they just pulled out of magazines or whatever and bought the rights to it and started selling it.
Mm-hmm. This actually, I believe, yeah, this is one of the things that Tony Diaz collected. So he had a giant collection of all kinds of things, and this was one of those things. It ended up selling for $182, so not bad.
The cover is interesting. It looks like they stopped drawing it like halfway down the page right. or something. Maybe it got
this
faded.
Is getting very sort of I don't know, anxious about it and angry and decided this is time to stop.
Good enough. Yeah, whatever. You get the message.
Okay, let's see. I guess another sort of related kind of thing. I'll skip over one just because we're getting kind of low on time. This is also from the same source. Something Tony Diaz collected. This is a game called Pie Man. I actually don't know the game really. It was for the Apple II. It was published by Penguin Software. I know it's relatively well known. What struck me about this one is that it says that it is published by Bearware, and that surprised me. I'd never heard of Bearware. I knew that Penguin Software had trouble with their name. That Penguin Books eventually came after them and said you can't use this name anymore, and so they switched their name to Polarware. Right. Bearware was new to me. I'd never seen this anywhere.
Before you mentioned Penguin, I was mm-hmm. going to point out that that is the Penguin font, the Bearware font. That's yeah. the font for Penguin, without question. So, in the name,
yeah.
Could Bearware have been on the way to Polarware? I guess Polar Bear.
That's what I was thinking. Is that it maybe has some relation somehow?
Yeah.
In fact, actually, the disc says Penguin.
Oh
so
yeah,
far
look
on
at
it.
That. That tips their hand right there, eh? That's funny. So, they must have switched, but it was too late to remake a bunch of their disc labels or something.
Weird.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
It was a good, I played that game a lot, actually. I recognized that game. I didn't recognize the name. I had to look up a screenshot. But when I saw the screenshot, I was like, oh, yeah, I played the heck out of that game. I had no idea it was Penguin Software or Bearware, of course, because I had a perfectly legitimate backup copy of it. But
right.
Yes. It was one of those games that was everywhere that you don't even imagine that it ever had a box because everybody just had 10 copies of it on compilation discs.
Right, right.
Yeah, the font on my disc looked a little more like my own handwriting, actually.
Mine did too.
It was not this font. Yeah, it was not that font. Huh. Yeah.
Yeah, mine didn't say Penguin on it. Mine said,
But they definitely sold it as Penguin earlier. I mean, like the Bearware one was very surprising. So I looked around a little bit, and the Museum of Computer Adventure Game History has a version of the Quest, which was also Bearware, a Penguin title that was later released, I guess, as Penguin. And it does say that in the notes to this, this is an unusual item in that box, identical to the standard Penguin release, but with all references to Penguin replaced by Bearware.
Oh, and it says the registration card said Polarware on it.
Yeah.
That's funny. So this, I guess very briefly, they named themselves Bearware, it sounds like.
Yeah. It, I think essentially the Penguin was a super well-established name. And then they caught the attention of the Penguin book publishers, who I guess maybe were starting to get into software or thought they might want to or something. And so they basically had a much heavier set of lawyers.
Yeah. Actually just finished that section of Lane's book. Also, there was a moment where all of the book publishers suddenly decided that software was going to be a thing, and they all just poured millions of dollars and armies of lawyers into it kind of all at once in the space of a certain year. I forget what year it was, but all of a sudden Scholastic and Penguin and all these other companies came after all the little software publishers and either bought them or sued them or partnered with them in some way.
Well, Polarware has a nicer ring to it than Bearware, I got to say.
Yeah. Yeah, I was actually looking around a little bit to try to see if I could find, any other information about Bearware. And I did. I found this tape, QVision Apple II review videotape that I lost track. Oh, yeah, it was recorded at Apple Expo East, I guess, in I don't know what year. But so there was a listing of, you know, one of the people they talked to on the show floor was Steve McQueen, Simplexity Software, that had Bearware and Context.js listed. But Bearware turned out to be actually like a software package by Simplexity. It turned out it wasn't actually.
There's Tony for Items Up.
Well, yeah, and so that was the thing that I actually kind of wanted to jump to here. There's a young Tony Diaz from Altec Electronics, talking a little bit about just various things. But one of the things he was showing off was his portable 2GS. So he took a Trona attaché and stuck a GS in it, and so this was being demoed as a possible kit or something that you might be able to make at some point in the future. At that point,
that's
1993,
neat.
I guess.
I like that.
Yeah.
It's like the forbidden love child of an Osborne and a 2GS.
Yeah. Right. And the attaché is really nice looking computer too. I really do like it as a sort of an aesthetic object. So, and he was talking a little bit there about maybe putting a like color LCD in there and it's in place of the CRT that's set up. So he had plans for it. I don't think it really got much further than the stage shown in this 1993 video. But Tom Weishaar is on the screen now in the same tape, and he's the one who started the Resource Central. Basically, it was like a follow up to the developers conference that happened annually for Apple II. Software, and it met in Kansas City, and this was the thing that became affectionately known as Kansas Fest and then turned into the thing that still happens today. So,
and Herb in the comments says that this was this video is Apple Expo West in 1993, and he was there. So how about that?
That's pretty excellent.
Yeah, so skim through the video and see if you can see Herb in the background anywhere.
Right. Anyway, so that's I guess that ends my eBay auctions, which is really just things that I thought of based on seeing eBay listings.
That's basically our entire show, so that's fine.
Yeah. So now we made it to closing discussions, and I guess, Blake, do you have any sort of closing notes?
Nothing really in particular. I'm going to have to look into this Dana possible Atari ST mobile system, but maybe I'll manage to just not do that and move on with life. But that was very cool. Trying to find time to get into some of the things that have been on the shelf that I want to get into. As I keep mentioning, the Naboo, which is waiting. So we'll see. Maybe I'll have some fun with that before the next show. And I see, look at this. Yeah, Earl's waving his Naboo around wildly with abandon. We might have to blur that out. But
we're gonna have to add the Naboo to our bingo cards for referencing it in every show. Yeah.
That with Fujinet.
Yeah, Fujinet, yeah, Naboo, Kay Savitz, Carrington's girlfriend. Yeah, we're building up a good bingo card here.
As long as you don't whip out your Sam Coupe, I think we'll all be fine.
Sam Coupe, there you go, that's fine.
Yeah.
And I think the central block in the bingo card is Retro Compute. You get that one for free because we all
understand. There you go. But anyway, so that's about it for me. How about you folks?
Earl, any closing thoughts, current activities?
Nothing here.
All right. Is it me? I guess it's me. I've been spending a fair amount of time sort of like getting the virtual end of Kansas Fest together. That's going to be... So the virtual part is called A24EVR, which I thought was... I'm very pleased with that name. But this year it's kind of Apple III themed, and so I've been working on trying to get a arcade game running on the Apple III. I sort of specifically using a graphics mode that they have that's on there that isn't on the Apple II. So it allows you to sort of scroll things vertically without a lot of cycles. And so I've been trying to make this little game where logs float down a river, whatever. It's it's getting there. I'm glad that there's still some time left. But we have the designer of the Apple III, Wendell Sander, is going to talk and answer questions. And Dave Ottolini, who is the Washington Apple Pi Apple III Special Interest Group chair for a long time, and who did a lot of sort of cheerleading for the Apple III. It's going to be pretty great. I didn't realize actually until quite recently that Washington Apple Pi is in the D.C. area and not on the West Coast. It's actually that Washington that it refers to. But
I should find out more about that. I know it's some of the folks in some of the RSC channels are, I think, in that group, but it's sort of ridiculous that I'm outside of D.C. and I'm not more familiar.
It's closer to me than I thought. It used to be one of the biggest, Apple user groups of the. They had a magazine and that sort of thing, but. Anyway, so that's largely what I've been doing. I've been trying to run into some really weird issues with trying to write, assembly code on the Apple III. And it's been fun discovering these undocumented things.
Well, isn't your game going to be like literally the third game ever written for the Apple III? There was only one or two back in the day, right?
Yeah, there weren't many. There were really a small number that were sort of Apple III specific. You could always run your Apple II, games in 48K black and white if you want, but
I think I've only ever heard of one, like in terms of actual dedicated Apple III games. So that's kind of neat. You're breaking ground.
Yeah.
Are you? Can I ask? Are you doing it entirely on the III itself, or are you using an emulator like on the side?
I am doing it entirely with MAME.
Okay.
I occasionally test it out on the machine next to me, but it's. Yeah, the thing is that MAME is really good, But one of the things that is kind of funny about the Apple III is that it tried to squeeze as much speed as it could out. And so it's not possible to run lower than 1 megahertz when it's drawing the screen. So anytime it's not drawing the screen, it shifts up to 2 megahertz. So when there's vertical blanking, when there's horizontal blanking, anytime it can. But MAME doesn't do that. MAME just goes at 2 megahertz. So it's easy to think that you're going, you know, that things are going better than they are. but also, yeah, there's some other stuff with like how vertical blanking interacts with the screen modes and stuff. So I discovered, I think, a new thing that maybe nobody knew before, that so when the vertical blanking signal goes off and, you know, it's no longer drawing on the screen, then I use that opportunity to switch the screen mode to something else, so that the idea was when the beam gets back to the top, it'll be in the mode I want at the top of the screen. But it turns out that on the actual hardware, it just gets stuck in whatever mode it was at the bottom. So if you do that, then there's a line at the top before it switches into the mode that you set during the blank. So I had to actually set the mode before the beam started heading back up the screen. And you know, probably people who look at the schematic might understand why that happens. But that was it, and MAME doesn't do that. MAME doesn't reflect that. So I didn't realize that until I got on the machine there, that like my top line wasn't in the right mode. So anyway, yeah.
You reminded me that while you're working on getting a game running on the Apple III, I should be working on getting an Apple III running.
Right.
So I have that one that I still have to do some troubleshooting on, and probably will buy one of the power supplies from Reactive Micro, because I think the power supply is not sending out good voltage, but it'll be great though, because when I get it running, then there'll be 3 games that I can make.
Excellent. Yeah, what was that? There was Captain Magneto, I think, was a game that was available on the Mac. It was originally written on the Apple III, but it was ported to the Mac, and I think that's maybe one of the higher profile games that exists on the Apple III. But yeah, I mean, otherwise, there's like a Pac-Man clone. It looks really nice, you know, but anyway, yeah. So that's what I've been doing. Quinn, any closing notes?
Yeah, I've been a very busy little retro beaver. So I think, so on the Commodore 64 front, I think, I don't remember where I left it in our last recording, but I did get a new power supply for it, and I was able to run some stuff with it. I was playing a couple of games. The keyboard on it was in really bad shape. So it was, you know how when keyboards get into that state where certain keys either only get every third tap, or sometimes you get a double tap, it was doing that on every single key pretty much. So it was just maddening to try and type on this thing. Even just like trying to load a game, it would take you, you know, 30 seconds of trying to get the load star thing to type correctly. And that, of course, makes playing games impossible if they're using the keyboard at all. So something had to be done about that. So I went and took the whole thing apart to clean the keyboard. Getting to the keypads on the Commodore 64 is a bit of an adventure, because the keyboard lifts off easily, but the whole keyboard is kind of a sealed unit that doesn't give you access to the contact pads on the undersides of the keys. The keys don't just pull out from the top or something like on the Apple II. So you have to desolder the EM shield on the underside of the keyboard. And then from there, you can then desolder all of the keys and then clean the, you don't have to desolder the keys, sorry. You have to, there was something else I had to desolder. I don't remember what it was. Oh, the...
there's a wire, isn't there?
Yes, there's a wire. The caps lock key is hardwired in, which is sort of hilarious. Like there's this one key that it looks like it was an afterthought. Like everything is modular except this one key that is soldered through the module that you have to remove. So you have to unsolder this one key. Anyway, then once you get it all apart, you get the EM shield off, then you can get in there and clean all the pads with alcohol. So I did that, cleaned them all, put it all back together, resoldered everything all back together, and it works perfectly now. So that was a win. It's still, it's a little bit unstable. Like after playing a game for like 10 minutes, it'll crash. And I don't think it's that all of the software I happen to have is buggy. I think it's probably something like a RAM chip or something is a little flaky, or I don't know. There's still something going on there. So I'm not sure. But and I think previously I'd also mentioned how I had taken apart the power switch and cleaned those contacts as well. So that's been working fine. So machine boots and runs fine now. So it's just this instability thing that I don't know what to do about. But it works well enough that I can play a game for 10 minutes, which is usually all I want to do anyway before it crashes. So that's been fun getting that going. Let's see. On the other front is on the 2GS side. So I've actually started working on my game again that I started. It's a little embarrassing. I looked at the date stamps on my first couple of source files in that game, and they are from 7 years ago. So I've literally been working on this thing for 7 years. I had no idea it's been going that long. I lost like 3 years for COVID because I didn't fly anywhere, and I didn't realize how much I was depending on airplane flights to work on this project. Because when you've got no internet, there's nothing else to do. So you get there with your laptop and work on retro stuff. It's easy. So since I didn't travel for 3 years, I just lost a bunch of time. So, you know, Paul and I were talking before the show that there's an inertia with projects like this. Once you stop for a long time, it's really hard to get back to them. But I did finally get back to this. And fortunately, I had left myself little notes in the code so I could remember what I was working on. Fixed a couple of very old bugs. So the game is, for anyone who doesn't remember my Kansas Fest presentation from 6 years ago, it's a kind of an artillery / scorched earth / worms type of game involving cats where you spit and throw bombs at each other. And then it's all played on a scrolling 2D deformable terrain. And progress has been actually quite good lately. So now just this week I've gotten animation working. I've gotten sound playing and it's starting to look and feel like a game finally. So that's kind of neat. For the first 5 years of its life, it was just a 2D scrolling deformable terrain tech demo basically. So now I'm slowly getting a game out of it. It will not be as good as the 7 year timeline would suggest it must be. So I may list it as 7 years in the making, which makes it sound like it must be incredible, but no, it's not going to be at all impressive technically, but I want to get it to a point where it's finished anyway, because I have a couple other ideas that I want to get going on, and I'm not letting myself start anything new until I finish this thing, which is a technique I use to actually finish things, because otherwise I'll just keep starting things and never finishing anything. So I don't let myself start the new exciting thing until this thing is done, or at least reasonably done. That is happening, and I guess I'm looking forward to the virtual K-Fest. I won't be at the in-person one, but I'm looking forward to the virtual one. And that's it for me, I think.
Excellent. All right. And that's it for this show. You can find the show notes for this and all the RCR shows at rcrpodcast.com. You can find lo-fi episodes and more via Gopher, also at rcrpodcast.com. You can discuss the show on the forums at vcfed.org somewhere. You can follow RCR on Mastodon at podcasts.social at rcrpodcast. Join our Facebook group at facebook.com/groups. RCR Podcast. You can send feedback to feedback@rcrpodcast.com. We are a member of the Throwback Network at throwbackreviews.com. And write a review on iTunes if you want. We hear it helps. And until next time.
Retro compute. I'm not waiting. I'm tired of waiting.
Yep.
That delay keeps getting longer and longer. We all keep waiting for everyone else to start. I'm just going for it now.